Welcome to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast. I'm your host, Brian Briscoe, and I've got an amazing guest with us today, and I'm just predicting the future here. I know we're going to have a really great show because we got Paul Shannon in the house. So, Paul, welcome.
What's up, Brian? Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, just having a great morning today, and hope you are too.
Absolutely. The sun is shining in Indianapolis in the middle of winter. We'll take that all day.
Yeah, right. Any day. I guess it's early afternoon where you're at. You're an hour ahead of me. But so let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about you. What I'd like to do is just go through your journey, you know, from where you started to get into real estate to where you are right now. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you came from, and how you got into real estate.
Yeah, absolutely. So I left my corporate job in 2019 to pursue real estate full time. But prior to that, for about a decade, I was in medical device and capital equipment sales. I was selling as a territory rep and then got into a consulting role where I was in the operating room. I was training surgical staff and ophthalmologists on how to use all the lasers and the equipment that are used for cataract surgery, the implants that went into the eye after the cataracts, the eye's natural lens was removed. So enjoyed that, had a lot of great experiences, and it was fruitful. And you know, as I got into that consulting role, I started traveling quite a bit more. I sort of liked presenting and being more high level. I was doing more implementation of some difficult technologies as far as the adoption of those technologies at that point. But with that travel, you know, I was overnight in hotels probably 80 nights for a couple of years in a row.
Yeah,
I was working, you know, odd hours where I'd have to be in the operating room at 7 a.m. So I was leaving the house very early. And you know, my kids were at that point. My daughter was about six, my oldest daughter, and I've got three kids now. At that point, I had two. My younger daughter was three. You know, I could see them kind of growing up, and dad was starting to miss out on some of the activities and stuff that I really wanted to be a part of. There was one kind of catalyst that stuck out in my mind. It was a Halloween that I had to be at a meeting in Las Vegas for. And, you know, I missed trick or treating. And it seems like, oh, you know, who cares? That's not a big deal. But you know, when you see the pictures and you get questions from the kids as to why daddy wasn't there. And I just kind of saw the writing on the wall that this was going to be the norm moving forward. And as my kids got into sports and activities and whatnot, I was going to have less and less of a presence around the house. So I knew I needed to make a change. So that was one big kind of like moment there. And I'd always had some interest in real estate up until that point. You know, I was enjoying my job to a degree, but it wasn't necessarily fulfilling wholly. And I was sort of working to save as much money as I could. And I figured, yeah, I want to retire early. And I'm going to kind of look towards that 4% rule where you can draw down 4% of your principal. It's called the Trinity Study. It was done in the 90s. And it showed that your money could last for a 30-year span, maybe longer if you drew less than that, maybe 3% of your principal balance. And you could live off your nest egg essentially forever. So I was trying to save as much and kind of was in that scarcity mindset where, you know, the less I spent or the less I went out to eat, or we don't need that vacation. We just need to sock away this money so I can get to that finish line as fast as possible. And, you know, I have no regrets with that mindset because we were able to save some money doing it. But I started to realize that I wanted to live more of an abundance type lifestyle and kind of
you want to enjoy life. You know, you want to take the kids to Disney, you know,
that's right.
Yeah. That's the stuff they remember.
That's right. And I didn't like the idea also of being, let's say, in my mid-40s and having to draw down on my principal. What if the market crashed by 40% and I needed to withdraw, you know, money just to survive and live? Well, that could be a real issue or something called sequence of return risks, where if you take your money out, you know, early in your retirement, it really is not recoverable. I wanted to find options to replace my income. And, you know, it wasn't going to come from bonds. Stocks were too volatile. You know, I was looking at that point, you know, 2016, 17, interest rates were super low. So bond yields were super low. They even got lower, as we all know, in hindsight. But, you know, I looked at real estate and saw that, hey, you know, I can play an active role in this. This is something that I think would be fun. I can improve communities, improve houses. I was thinking along those lines at that point. And, you know, I can hold these properties. They're going to appreciate. They're going to have less correlation to the stock market, and they're going to produce a lot more income than bonds. And if I can just maybe replace 50% of my income and then live off the principal that I have saved for the other bucket of capital that I need to retire, maybe, you know, at that point I could leave W-2 work behind. So that's really the catalyst to think about real estate in a different light.
That's what I'm starting to call like the trigger event. That Halloween thing is like the trigger event that I'm starting to look at. And You know, I look back at my life and I remember getting a voicemail from my daughter. She's 22 right now. This is when she was like 8 or 9 years old. And it was like, "Daddy, I scored a goal today," you know, and it's soccer. And it's just like, I'm on the other side of the country. And it's just like, that was the only soccer goal she ever scored, you know, and she played soccer all the way through high school. She was a defender and, you know, only goal she ever scored, and I was gone for it. But, that trigger moment kind of moved you into that thinking of what do I do next? And I think that's very, very common amongst, you know, people who go through the same journey. So hit your trigger, you looked at what you want to do, and you said real estate. So let's take it from there. You know, you decided the real estate, you can buy it, you can get cash flow, you can get the appreciation. How did you progress from there?
So in 2016, I bought a duplex. At that point, I was sort of doing everything myself. I was managing the property, so to speak. I was, you know, working with the tenants. It was an older property, so there were maintenance issues. So I started to develop relationships with contractors and understand kind of the bones of old houses and what couldn't, you know, could go wrong. And, you know, wanted to kind of scale more and more. So I was looking at acquiring different properties around town. I got a couple of single family homes that I bought as bank-owned properties, real estate-owned, REOs. That's really where I kind of got my feet wet. I had some pretty heavy rehabs of those properties and, you know, I was utilizing the BRRRR strategy. And frankly, there were a ton of issues. You know, I had, you know, problems with contractors. I structured my contracts inappropriately. I went over budget, you know, tons of mistakes. I was still working, you know, full-time and traveling quite a bit. Ended up having to fire my contractor, who's my GC, and I was spending my weekends there finishing the job, doing the manual labor myself. But when I came out the other side and the project was complete, we rented it with a tenant. I was learning property management software. I thought I was going to grow a property management company at that time, which I definitely didn't do effectively whatsoever, and went in a different direction. But we were able to refinance that property. I pulled out all the capital that I had invested myself. We bought that place for, I think, 55 or so. We put 30 into it and it appraised for 145. So we got our $85,000 back out. Loan to value was in the, 70 maybe or so. So we were pretty conservative and we were still cash flowing. So I was like, from there, my confidence really grew and I started to move towards, you know, maybe I should be able to do this full time. So we did 4 or 5 of those. And then in 2019, you know, with limited experience and certainly not the income that I needed to replace my job, I had the support of my family. My wife, she said, you know, you're enjoying what you're doing. All that's holding you back at this point is time. And I agreed. And I said, yes, let's go all in on this. And if it works out, you know, great. And if it doesn't, you know, 2 years from now, I'll just say, hey, this was fun. Let's get back into what I was doing before. I can fall back in my old career.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's a good point. You know, when I looked at, you know, should I leave my job? You know, I did like the worst case scenario analysis. You know, what happens if I fail? You know, what happens if I quit my job and I start doing things? The answer in my head was, well, I'll just have to go get another job. And when I really started thinking about it, it was like, that's exactly what I'm doing right now. I am living my worst case scenario, you know?
Yeah, isn't that really the worst that could happen? Oh, no. Like, if you start to think about what could go right instead of thinking about the worst case scenarios, it's amazing how your mindset can shift.
But yeah, even when you think about the worst case scenario, it's like, yeah, I'm living my worst case scenario. And then you look at, exactly what you said. When you start looking at what could go right, what if this works? You know, oh, my goodness. Amazing thing. So looking at that decision point, what was, I guess, the scariest thing for you leaving your job to do real estate full time?
Just the uncertainty, I would say, at that point. You know, you have kind of the bird in the hand. I had worked so hard through my career. I was kind of one of those people where I would work towards a promotion. I'd even move around the country. We took 5 moves or so in 15 years to advance our careers, my wife and I. And, you know, when you put that much time, energy, effort, sacrifice into something like that, and then you finally reach, I guess, a level where you're like, man, if I had looked back 10 years ago and knew I'd be here today, I'd sign up immediately. Still sort of disappointed. And you're like, what is it? You know, what is it that I'm supposed to be doing to make me happy? I guess to answer your question, it was like, I'm giving up this income, I'm giving up all this hard work, and maybe I'm, you know, setting my career back. If I do have to go back, I've got a good reputation. I can get back into the business. But at the same time, like, you know, you feel like maybe you're leaving some chips on the table. But I did feel there was an opposite feeling that was kind of pulling me in a different direction, where I felt like, I'm never going to know if I can do this unless I take this risk. And the biggest risk at that point, when I made that decision, was not taking a chance on myself. That was when I was like, I know I need to do this because if I fail, I can look at myself in the mirror and say, man, you had the bravado to actually go out and do what you thought you could do and, you know, do what you wanted to do and do it with confidence. If I failed, I could still kind of hold my head high. I couldn't hold my head high though, if I never took the chance.
Yeah, I love it. I think with some of the most important career decisions in my life, I did something that's like non-standard in the military, took a job that was non-standard. And I remember one of my bosses, you know, I went to him to ask for advice and he told me not to do it. I said, why not? He's like, this is not a standard thing. He's like, the way promotion system works is you have to do the standard things. You know, if you want, you know, and I remember walking away from that conversation and thinking 40 years from now, looking back, would I want to be the guy that did what everyone else did? Or would I do, or do I want to be the guy that took that non-standard job? And that non-standard job put me in Rio de Janeiro for a year, which, you know, looking back at it, yeah, absolutely.
What an experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd rather have the experience. I'd rather have my kids have that experience. And if I, you know, if I give up a little bit on the backside for it, great. Fine. So you started doing this full time. Walk us through that. And I know you went from small multifamily to larger multifamily really quickly. Let's walk through that progression, how that happened.
Well, as I mentioned before, I was a poor property manager. I wasn't efficient at it. I decided, you know, I guess my original plan was to grow a couple teams of contractors, be flipping some houses of my own, having some rentals, reinvesting the flip profits into the rentals, keeping those contractors busy enough where I'd be able to kind of manage properties for other investors and grow this property management business. Well, I didn't want to do something I wasn't, you know, passionate about. And I found out pretty early on, this wasn't, you know, the job for me. It was one of the dirtiest jobs in the business. And my skill sets were more towards networking, putting together teams, financial analysis, working with lenders and putting together deals. That's what really excited me. So ironically, you know, I don't know if I ever would have gotten out of what I was doing if the market hadn't kind of shifted. The strategy that I was employing in Indianapolis sort of stopped working, and I wasn't borrowing private funds or raising investor capital at that point. I was using my own money, which was finite. So the Burr strategy, the house that I described earlier, where I could pull out all my money, that sort of stopped working. And I was only able to get out maybe 80% of my money. So I realized if I do this, you know, 5-6 times over, I'm going to run out of money. It's going to be locked up in these houses and I'm not going to be able to move forward anymore. At least that's what I thought at the time. So
yeah,
I started looking at tertiary markets and, you know, a number of smaller metros that, you know, still had the ability to utilize that strategy. And I landed in Evansville, Indiana, which is on the southern border of Indiana and just borders Kentucky. And, you know, same thing. I bought a house down there. I found a property manager who I kind of hit it off with, who was a young guy that, you know, did have the infrastructure in place and enjoyed the property management business and had kind of the skill sets and the piece that I was missing. And I think that's critical when you're building out a team is to find people that aren't necessarily the same as you. Otherwise, you might be in the same spot as you were when you first met them. If you join up as a team, you got to find people that are complementary to you, that fill some of your gaps and your shortcomings and inefficiencies. And that, to me, was him.
Yeah.
And he was 3 hours from me, too. So I had to kind of be a little bit more hands-off, where I was typically, you know, very micro as far as the details in my local area. Being 3 hours, you know, apart, I couldn't really, you know, drive by the property. I couldn't check in on the rehab. So I had to kind of instill some trust in this person. And they ended up becoming my partner today. So it worked out pretty well. But that's really where things started to scale for me. And that was in 2019. We bought, first he flipped this house for me. I shouldn't say flip. He did the renovations. We refinanced it and he, you know, managed it for me. Went very well. He stayed within budget, got a good tenant in there. And we did that, you know, multiple times over. We bought about 20 units in 2019. And in 2020, we just started to get into larger properties, a duplex, 4-unit, 8-unit. And then we got into a 40-unit down there and then found a 40-unit in Indianapolis. It was always just networking and trying to meet as many people as possible where there could be opportunities to, you know, uncover deals that, you know, maybe weren't on market. And that's been a good strategy for me. So
yeah,
that's where we are today. We've transacted on about 200 units or so. We got about 115 or so in my portfolio now. We sell some stuff, we hold some stuff, depending on the scenario. If we get a good enough price, especially unsolicited, we'll let stuff go. But like the income, but also like the profits, where you can kind of realize some of the value you've created in these properties, and let another buyer take it from there. And so that's kind of the journey from the active side. I've been investing passively as a limited partner as well, to get in the syndication game and kind of spread my assets and diversification across the country with operators who are really good in their local markets, whether it's multifamily or other asset classes that I can't do myself, and stayed afloat so far. So haven't had to go back to that W-2.
And hopefully everything stays afloat. You know, when you have lots of properties, you're not the one that manages them, but when you are the one that manages them, you're doing a lot of juggling. But one thing I want to kind of dial in on is that 40 unit. That seemed to be a big jump, 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, those are all reasonable jumps. Talk a little bit about, the why behind it. And if you would, talk about the scale. Is the 40 unit easier to manage per unit than a 4 or an 8?
I'll answer that question first. The answer is definitely yes. And one of the reasons is if you think about houses, they're all different. They each have different footprints. They're different vintages, meaning they were built in different eras. So they have different era problems. Stuff that was built in the 70s might have aluminum wiring. Stuff that was built, 100 years ago may have, plumbing that is really shoddy and needs to be replaced, or, may have knob and tube wiring. You don't see much of that anymore, but there are these unique problems that really don't allow you to create efficiencies and how you approach renovations. Every one of them is different, and it's hard to kind of budget and manage that rehab process when it's not cookie cutter. So in an apartment building, really, you might have a one bed, one bath, maybe a two bed, one bath, maybe a three bed, two bath. But each one of those bed, bath, unit mixes are sort of like a cookie, once you do one and you've got your pricing for your cabinets and your countertops and your flooring and your bathroom surround and carpet, et cetera, your windows, everything is the same. So you can kind of plug and play. Once you get the one done, you can go to the next one. You know exactly what your costs are going to be. There's really not any surprises. So it's very efficient from that standpoint. And then, when you think about vacancy, if you've got a single family home and you have a move out, usually the floor plans are bigger, so sometimes your turnover costs are a lot higher. When that vacancy occurs, you're at 0% occupancy, you're 100% vacant, you're bringing in no income. So that can be kind of worrisome. When am I going to get this next good tenant? How long are they going to stay? With a multifamily property, if you've got 40 units and you have a move out and you're at 100% occupancy, you're still at 97.5 and get a tenant that moves out. So you really almost don't even notice fluctuations if you're keeping up with maintenance and keeping your property an attractive place to live in the community. You can survive with 10% fluctuations in your vacancy and really not really blink an eye. So those are some of the efficiencies I found. And then you can create a lot of value too in multifamily, just the way that commercial properties or multifamily residential properties are valued. Instead of a single family home that's measured versus its comps in the area, its competition, comparable market sales. If I've got a rental and it's a three bed, one bath, that's 1,000 square feet, find me the nicest one with a, mile radius. And that's pretty much the highest price that I could ever get for that property.
Yeah.
I may have to make some renovations to get it up to that standard. So it's apples to apples, but I really can't drive much more value than that. Whereas with a multifamily property that's based off of income times the multiplier of a cap rate, you can force appreciation much more aggressively. Where if you look at cap rates today, let's just say it's a 5 cap, and you add $100 in rent to a unit by improving it on the inside and updating the interiors, where a tenant would pay that additional premium, you take that $100 and you divide it by 0.05, and that's the additional value that you've created just from doing that renovation. And what is that off the top of my head? I can't even think of it. Let's do a quick exercise here. 100 times 12 is 1,200, right? So
right. That's
a year. And then divide that by a 5 cap. That's $24,000. You just added to the value of your property by spending, maybe $10,000, to do the renovation on the interior and raising your rent by $100. So you can see how that can snowball across 40.
The multiples are definitely there. Yeah, absolutely.
So And there's some costs associated with that. So that's a pretty raw example, but it's real. I mean, you can really drive value in these properties. So I found that to be really efficient. And that's what attracted me, going back to your initial question, to multifamily, was just that ability to scale much more efficiently and faster. And at the time, you know, there were really good dynamics in the marketplace. I mean, you know, the interest rates were very low. We're locked into that property right now at a 4.15% interest rate for another 8
nice
years.
Rate, yeah.
We initially bought that place and we put a couple $100,000 in, and we refinanced out our entire principal. So we have $0 in that deal for our own capital at this point.
Nice. It
still generates a nice amount of cash flow per year. Now, it's very difficult to do that in today's market. It's impossible, I would say.
It is. Yeah. Unfortunately. I you know, with where rates are and prices haven't exactly adjusted, I hope we eventually get back to the point where you can do that, you know, but, you know, if not, there's still a lot of value here.
Yeah, no question. I think there's, I think what's different today is that, you know, a lot of investors have gotten so used to those juicy returns that they're unwilling to look at the more sustainable picture, which is that, you know, hey, let's say it's a 12% IRR or a 14% IRR. That's still pretty good. Where else are you going to find that?
Is that necessarily bad? Yeah. I mean, what's the S&P giving you, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. So, so you mentioned, before we hit the record button, and you kind of brought it up a little earlier, you started a fund, you know, to invest in other stuff. Can you go into a little bit more, first of all, why, and go a little bit into what you're doing with that fund?
So why did we start it? There's a number of reasons. One was, going back to what we were just talking about, the market isn't the same anymore. We were kind of, I was kind of that guy where it was like, I'm still looking for that same, I guess, you know, golden goose egg, you know, or that golden egg that's going to be that property that I can scale quickly and get my capital back out. And we started to kind of look at bringing investors into the fold at that point too. And this was back in early 2022, the exact wrong time to kind of scale a business in the syndication model.
And, true.
We were very, I guess, aware of the macro environment. Another guy I was working with at the time, you know, we felt that the, you know, federal funds rate was at zero at that point. And Jerome Powell had been saying that inflation was transitory, but kind of started to shift his position on that and was sort of telegraphing rate hikes because inflation had, you know, ended up at 9% and wasn't going down. So interest rates were going to go up. We knew that. And we also knew that cap rates were, you know, heavily correlated to interest rates. The cost of capital does impact asset values. I wouldn't say on a one-to-one correlation, but it's pretty influential. So we thought, you know, if people are paying like 3 cap pricing for deals in certain markets and using aggressive floating rate bridge debt, there's a real high probability that there could be some problems with that. We don't know exactly what, but we wanted to stay out of hot water, particularly with my primary motivation being I don't want to go back to my W-2 job and I want to stay alive here.
Yeah.
So we started underwriting to fixed rate debt. We were, you know, debt service coverage restrained, meaning we could only pay a certain amount and take on a certain debt load that would be serviced by the income that the property produces today, not in the future. So the difference between a pro forma lender who will lend a borrower based on a future value and what they're planning to do with the property versus a lender that lends on actual financials of the seller that you're inheriting the property from. So we were doing the latter, and you know, most people were still underwriting pretty aggressively and using floating rate and doing the opposite. So we were, because they could, you know, access cheaper capital and at the time anyways, which it turned out to be more expensive capital really, you know, we were getting smoked on all the offers we put in. We put in about 200 LOIs in 2022 and we didn't get one of them. So there's reason number one, we were banging our heads against the wall. And, you know, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expect a different result, you're the definition of insane, right? So we didn't want to be insane. So we decided we need to pivot. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we had been investing, or I had been investing as an LP with my wife in, you know, asset classes outside of multifamily. Had built some connections and assets like industrial, retail, mixed use development, private money lending, notes, ATM machines. So saw that there was this whole world of income producing assets in the syndication world and was doing pretty well with those deals. You know, kind of wanted to open up my mind a little bit more. We were very hyper-focused on Indianapolis and Evansville at that time because we felt like that's where we had the advantage, the relationships, and didn't necessarily want to grow from a geography standpoint to open up our breadth. So why not just expand and, you know, look at things more from a limited partner perspective? And, you know, if you think about where we are today, we started the fund in the middle of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, interest rates had gone up quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, there were deals that started to go a little sideways, distributions pause, capital calls, you know, potentially we may see worse this year in the headlines. So there's other LPs that are, you know, accredited investors, very smart individuals that just don't have the time to really vet these deals, right? At a really, you know, granular level where they're reading the PPM, the operating agreement, they're, you know, scrutinizing the underwriting and the inputs that lead to the outputs that are on the OM. A lot of people just looked at the OM and said, yeah, I'll take a flyer. Let's do this deal. So we thought there was an opportunity to operate a fund where we would invest as LPs ourselves with our own capital, but we could also bring in other LPs that, you know, may look to us and say, hey, you know, what do you think about this deal? You're investing in it. Can I get involved too? So maybe a little bit more of a curated approach. We're not registered investment advisors. We're not, you know, telling people what they should do with their money. We're just saying, hey, we're investing in this and we're opening it up to people that are interested. So that was one. But the reason I think that the timing was right was because, you know, because a lot of these deals had gone the way they had gone, you know, LPs, a lot of them had, there were a lot that wanted to participate, but there are others that had sort of like sidelined themselves. It was much harder to raise. So if you're a general partner, there's a lot of value in a fund coming in and writing a single check, let's say for $1 million, versus having to go raise $1 million from.
I'll take that $1 million check any day, you know, 8 days a week. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
And would you give better terms for it is the question.
Yeah. If you could guarantee it, you know, if you came to me and said 100% absolutely positively guaranteed, you know, $1 million check. Yes, I would give you better terms for it.
And that's what we're finding. I mean, that's the value we can bring as we streamline the capital sources to the general partners. We get better terms that we can pass along to our investors, and then we can monetize our fund too. So it's like, okay, now we can look at an industrial deal in Phoenix.
Yeah.
We can look at, you know, anything we want really anywhere in the country. And it's really been fun because, you know, we were trying to allocate our own capital and having a frustrating time doing it. And now we're seeing so many different deals that we're getting involved with. Sometimes they don't even work for a fund, but I'm investing myself. Yeah. So that's really the impetus behind the fund. And I think, you know, long-term, I like operating. I like physical real estate. I like this too, but this is more of a capital allocation role versus in the weeds on the project, operating it day in and day out, asset managing. I want to connect that someday, and I'm not right. You know, I'm not quite there, but that's the long-term vision.
So I will like to point out, you know, if you rewind this, you did at one point say Streamline Capital, which, you know.
Oh, hey.
Streamline Capital. That's my company right there. So anyway, so there was a very intentional plug for Streamline Capital there that I heard. I don't know if everyone else heard it right. Everybody listening to this right now is going to hit that, you know, back 30 button. But
I didn't even compensate me for that comment.
I know, right? Yeah, freely given, but love it. That's why I named the company Streamline Capital, is because it just made sense. But, you know, going back to, you know, things that matter out of what you said, you know, not just the incidental, you know, naming of my company, but, you know, it was a tough time. Last 2 years have been really tough for investors. One thing I've heard multiple times from people with money to invest is I'd rather keep my money in a money market account right now that's paying 4-5% interest than take a risk in apartments. And that's what a lot of people have been saying. And so when you start looking at, you know, you did a really quick pivot, you started a fund, it gives you flexibility. It's okay, multifamily might not be where the money's flowing right now, but it gives you an opportunity to go where the money's flowing, you know. So I've seen a lot of people in the last 2 years do exactly that. So anyway, thanks for that. All right, we got a couple minutes left. So I basically got two more questions for you. Okay, question number one, you know, what's next for you?
You know, right now I'm just really focused on the fund and, you know, finding good opportunities for our investors. We're really focused in on, you know, trying to create value through asymmetric risk return profiles. So, you know, finding deals where there might be limited downside, but we're really focused in on principal preservation with the opportunity for really big upside. So a couple of the deals that we've done have been, you know, debt funds. They're lower in the capital stack, meaning that, you know, we're basically operating in a position where we're the lender. So we have collateral in the underlying real estate. Our last dollar of exposure from a leverage standpoint is about 75% of the value of the property. So even if the property declines in value, or, you know, our sponsor has to take back, you know, the property through a foreclosure, our money is still, you know, very well protected from and insulated from any sort of economic or operational problems. And there, you know, because lending market is kind of dried up right now, you know, if there are these sort of private, you know, funds out there that are providing sort of a gap in the market, there's a low supply and high demand from borrowers, they could command like higher interest rates. So we're getting equity-like returns on some of these deals with, you know, much less risk. So we are looking at equity deals where, you know, I'm still very interested in multifamily. I think there's great operators out there, much, much better than, you know, what I was able to accomplish in multifamily. So I'm looking at folks like that, that are, you know, decades ahead of where I am in that space, that still can find really good deals because they have unfair advantages in their markets and have been operating there forever and just know how to get stuff done and are maybe vertically integrated and understand market cycles, et cetera. We're looking at other asset classes as well too, but that's really, I think, where my focus is going to be going into, you know, even into 2025, and we'll see how the market kind of, you know, changes over that time period and whether there'll be opportunities to operate physical real estate in my market.
Love it. Love it. Absolutely. All right. So last question, what advice would you give to an aspiring investor who's just starting the journey?
Oh man, there's so many nuggets out there. I would say a couple things. Like, I would definitely be listening into podcasts like yours and kind of finding inspiration from other people who have sort of taken the plunge and done it. That's one. Two, I would kind of study up on financial history and get literate as to what's happened in the past. You know, you see a lot of headlines and clickbait and news articles that talk about what happened, you know, 10 minutes ago. News is so instantaneous. You can get kind of caught up in opinions and you don't necessarily know what's fact and what's not. Pick up a book instead that was written like, you know, 100 years ago. Look at, you know, what's happened from the 1700s up until today. One of my favorite books is The Creature from Jekyll Island. And there's just like these patterns in history that just happen over and over and over again. And usually it's around greed and there's a bubble. And then there's, you know, the fall and the collapse. And there's people that pick through all the cigar butts and sort of, you know, the pieces and put them back together. And those are the ones that end up amazing wealth and, you know, some of the people that you hear about in history books today. But a lot of the stuff, history doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes, Mark Twain, right?
Yeah.
You can kind of pick up on these patterns from past history and apply them to today, and you're getting much more value out of that. And then lastly, number three, I'd say is just get out there and network, you know, because for me, when I first started, I tried to go in and out alone. And I wish I would have gotten into circles sooner where I, you know, started to expose myself to different ideas that I never thought was possible. I just thought, hey, I'm going to, you know, flip houses and have some rentals and have this property management company. I wasn't thinking along the lines of operating a fund at that point whatsoever. Yeah. So my path has looked much different than how I thought I had it laid out when I left my W-2. And I'd say that you don't have to have everything figured out. It doesn't have to be perfect. Once you start progressing one foot in front of the other, you start to see the forest through the trees. And the more people you interact with, the more ideas you get, the more opportunities expose themselves. And, you know, the path kind of opens up for you.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, cool. Hey, thanks a lot for all those nuggets. I think that's sound advice. History doesn't repeat itself. It rhymes. And if history is rhyming with the last couple of, you know, times that multifamily has, you know, gotten down in value, we're in for a really good couple of years coming up. So I am, you know, figuratively picking through those cigar butts right now and trying to find that next one. Incidentally, while we were recording, I did get a text. I love this one. It's basically said that a buyer on a project we were looking at a couple months ago just fell out and we're next in line. So, I know.
You got to let me go.
That's the no. Well, you know what? You know, that's not something I have to answer within the next 2 seconds. That's something that I can get back in 30 minutes. When we start talking about that, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, if you mentioned this earlier, you know, the people who are persistent, the people who are out there, you know, you get access to some of these deals because you're out there persistent, you're hustling, you're doing things. And it's, I love that idea you said where you're setting up an unfair advantage for yourself And, you know, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is set up that unfair advantage. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox and, you know, get back to closing this episode up. But last question, how can listeners learn a little bit more about you?
Can I tell a cool story real quick, Brent?
Yes.
It just kind of like dawned on me, like as we were chatting here, about putting yourself in the right place and then having it sort of like come back around to you.
Uh-huh.
You and I had lunch at the Best Ever Conference in, I think, 2021.
Yep.
And at that lunch, I met a kid that was sitting next to me. He's not a kid. He's my age. I call him a kid, but he's a guy. And we had a great conversation. And he lives in Philadelphia. And, you know, we exchanged phone numbers, et cetera, et cetera. It was probably like 3 months after that.
Mm-hmm.
He looks me up. I think it was on LinkedIn. And he said, "Hey, you have time to talk sometime?" I said, "Yeah, give me a call. You got my number, right?" So he calls me up and he says, "I don't know if you saw this on Facebook or not, but there was this guy that was trying to sell this 40-unit apartment. And it may be too late. It may not." I said, "I'd definitely like to take a look. Are you interested in it? I'm not going to, you know, cherry pick your deal away from you." He's like, "No, I don't have the time for it right now and the capital and everything else." He's just like, "I thought of you because we had lunch, you know, and he mentioned what you were up to." And so I ended up getting in touch with this guy, and he had a cash offer in hand for this deal. And I knew the basis was so low, but there was so much meat left on the bone. And, you know, long story short is I came to him and I said, "Don't sell the property today." I was like, "Here's my plan to increase the value. I will fund the CapEx. We'll go through and we'll, you know, drive this much value out of it. The rents, here's all the comps. Here's what we can get. And if we finish this plan, here's what the property will be worth." And I basically made it so he would make a lot more money and I would make some money too. And the deal went through, and we're actually set to close on selling the property in a couple of weeks from today. So it's been almost 2 years now. A lot of stuff's happened in between, some fun, some not fun. But the point of the story is that, you know, to your point, the more you get out there, the more you network, the more you meet people. And that was, I never tied it back to that lunch, but that's when I met Chris, and it was like, wow, that's crazy to think now, 3 years later.
Speaking of stories, you arranged a dinner at a really nice steak place. Jake and Gino is where that was. And so we sat at the table at Jake and Gino, and the guy that I was sitting next to, I partnered with a couple of times, you know, and there was a point a couple of years ago, several months ago, where we were this close to losing a property because our equity raise was going a little slow. And I picked up the phone, called him, and he figured out how to get us to the closing table. You know, it's just one of those things where, you know, if you hadn't invited me to dinner that day, you know, I wouldn't have sat next to him. And I wouldn't have known him. I mean, we probably would have figured out how to make it happen. But, you know, I picked up the phone. I called him. He's like, "How much do you need?" He's like, "Yeah, I can fund it right now. Can you pay me back in a month?" "Yeah, we can pay back in a month." "All right, cool. Here's what it's going to cost you." Awesome. And we closed the property. Big, you know, he got what, you know, what he wanted out of it. I got what I wanted out of it. But yeah, networking is awesome. But last question, how can listeners learn more about you?
Yeah, check us out for our fund at investwisecollective.com. My active real estate business in Indianapolis is redhawkinvesting.com. And then you can catch me on LinkedIn as well. I'm pretty active there.
All right. So we'll put links to all of that in the show notes. So anybody listening, you want to reach out to Paul, that's how you do it. Two websites, LinkedIn. And you want to reach out to me, you know, LinkedIn is the best place to do it. You know, if you're not connected, hit that connect button. And if you are connected, just send me a DM. So anyway, that's it for today. Thanks, Paul, for coming on today. And don't wait to buy apartments. Buy apartments and wait. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Brian.